Where the Wild Things Are hits theaters tomorrow. Director Spike Jonze will try to bring to life the fuzzy but majestic monsters of the beloved children's book. But monsters have changed quite a lot since Maurice Sendak wrote his 300-some words in 1964. From Monsters, Inc. to Shrek, many present-day monsters seem to be, well, tamed. Today, Roger White joins us to talk about monsters of the past and how Sendak helped make the world safe for monsters today. We also want to hear your stories. What monsters have stuck with you? Give us a call at 800-989-8255. Email us at talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our website and find a link to Roger White's article in the Boston Globe. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Roger White, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi.
Why do you think Sendak's Wild Things changed our perceptions of monsters?
Well, I think it was one of the first times where monsters became less, you know, figures of terror and were suddenly very accessible, friendly, lovable creatures that you wanted to hang out with rather than, you know, tormentors.
Well, the monsters, they're not that lovable. I mean, you know, they've got big teeth and long claws and yellow eyes.
Right, yeah, yeah, no, it's true. One of the interesting things about Sendak's Wild Things is that they're a very strange mixture of, you know, the legitimately frightening, horrific. You know, they have all the sort of classical attributes of monsters, the scales and the claws and the fangs and the mismatched animal parts, but at the same time, there's something sort of endearing about them. And I think a lot of the reason for that is that Sendak, in fact, based the Wild Things on these caricatures of people that he knew, of his relatives, stuff. So that, you know, beneath the monstrousness, there is this sort of friendly, familiar core.
Well, also that idea of mismatching body parts from different animals is throughout classical art.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things about the Wild Things is that if you're looking for maybe a genealogy of where visually they came from, you can look all the way back to Greek myth, where you had like the chimera, which was a lion crossed with a snake, crossed with a goat, or you had the Cerberus, which is a three-headed dog, you know, all these sort of bizarre agglomerations of very familiar things.
It's interesting to see where the Wild Things Are as a transitional moment, too, because while Max doesn't run screaming from the monsters, he also doesn't stay with them. He doesn't, you know, become a warm and fuzzy monster himself.
Right, that's true. I mean, it seems like it's very much about passing through a strange experience, you know. I mean, but compared to, you know, if the Wild Things were a Greek myth, Max would sail to the land of the Wild Things. He would have to slay them or run in terror or have this confrontation. But instead, you know, there's a moment at the beginning where it's possible that they're going to eat him, but he sort of makes peace. You know, they have a party, and then he returns home. You know, it's a different way of dealing with something that's weird and disturbing.
We are talking about our favorite monsters here on Talk the Nation. You can join us at 800-989-8255. Let's hear from Bill in Mount Vernon, Iowa. Bill, welcome to Talk the Nation.
I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
And your subject is near and dear to my heart. My first memory of a monster, I was 4 years old. I'm 61 now. And I ran screaming out of the theater when King Kong reached through that window for Fay Wray. And my grandmother loved to recount that story for most of my life.
So King Kong is certainly an ancestor of today's more fuzzy, cuddly monsters and an ancestor of the Wild Things.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Sendak in interviews talked about, you know, maybe like the genesis of his love of storytelling was that he would go to these creature features as a kid and relay the stories back to his friends who hadn't seen the movie. And if they hadn't seen the movie, he could elaborate and make them sort of even more fantastical. Probably, you know, King Kong was very likely something that he would have seen.
Let's hear from Bob in McAllen, Idaho. Bob, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to share that when I was a child, there were alligators under my bed, and it was a point to get to the end of the bed and jump as far away from it as I could so that they wouldn't come after my feet. And now as an adult, I keep a cement lawn ornament alligator under my bed all the time because it keeps the other ones at bay.
Ah, so you've co-opted the monster under your bed to control the monster population.
Exactly. It's better the alligator that you know.
Bob, thanks for your call. The under the bed thing seems almost universal.
Yeah, I wonder if, I mean, it must be sort of like, as long as there have been beds, there have been monsters under them, right?
Right. And I guess it's the, you know, the lights are out and what's unknown. And
yeah, definitely. That's another reason I think that the book was so fantastic is that, you know, in the book, Max, it's not like he actually travels to this other place. His bedroom becomes, you know, is transformed into this unknown land and then transformed back into his bedroom, you know, when it's over.
We haven't talked much about the actual art of Sendak's book. What, as an artist, what do you make of it?
I mean, they're just beautiful illustrations. You know, when you think about it, I mean, there's very few words in the book. In fact, it's all pictorial. You know, the book, there are these lovely watercolor washes over which, you know, Sendak has gone with a pen and ink and really gotten into these rendering the, you know, the physicality of these monsters. You know, this like very maniacal cross-hatching that he does, and what really comes out is just the, you know, the texture of them. They're very furry. You know, I think it's like a central aspect of the Wild Things is that they're these like hairy creatures, and the way that he draws them really brings that out. And once again, everything is just, it's on the one hand they're very flat. The pictures, they're like these could be a frieze on the side of a, you know, like a, on a bas-relief sculpture. At the same time, you know, there's this incredible depth to them, this richness of the color.
Do you see echoes of monster paintings from the Middle Ages?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, if you look at something like Hieronymus Bosch, who was a Netherlandish painter working at the beginning of the Renaissance, you know, he'd make these enormous canvases filled with tiny little figures of, like, demons and monsters that are, you know, tormenting sinners. And you know, a lot of them, you know, there's a very similar thing going with hybridization. It'll be like a rabbit with, you know, like a human body or a giant mouse or a fish with wings. You know, it's the same sort of, you know, putting different things together into strange combinations. But those were very much about frightening you to death, you know, and keeping you sort of on the path of good behavior, whereas Sendak is obviously about something different.
Let's hear from Doc in Oklahoma City. Doc, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, and thank you so much for taking my call. You've hit upon a subject that, again, is near and dear to my heart. I've been a fan of monster movies since a little child back in the 50s, and I would have to say, out of all of them, it was a toss-up between Rodan and Godzilla, but Godzilla won out for a number of reasons. Number one, I enjoy all of the early Japanese genre. I think they did a super job. I always enjoyed the miniatures, but much like the tornadoes that we have in Oklahoma, you can see Godzilla coming. He is about 400 feet tall. and there is a certain tragedy there, especially at the end. He's all-powerful, and he's unstoppable, and he just runs the gauntlet, and then a simple little device strips him of his bones and his immortality, if you will. I think that entered into it, too. But the one thing that always stood out in my mind about Godzilla, and this is a funny part of it, was they found a trilobite, you know, a little invertebrate worm, basically, from the Cretaceous period. And that always caught my interest, that little trilobite they found, and which forced me to go into the geologic field as I got older. I studied geology down at OU back in the 60s for that reason. And you can really blame Godzilla for it. It's all his fault.
Doc, thanks for your call. We also have a bunch of calls and emails about the Jim Henson monsters, both pro and con. Surprisingly, we do have some con Jim Henson monster emails. This is Rob, who says, as much as they scared me as a kid, I've always loved any Jim Henson monster, but the big pink ones from the beginning of the show haunted my nightmares. And Stacy says, I loved the monster at the end of this book, who is, of course, Grover. Let's take a call from Catherine in Menlo Park, California. Catherine, welcome to Talk the Nation.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. First of all, I have to say, in terms of Jim Henson, I always loved Grover because he always kind of got things wrong, and you always have to relate to that as a child. But you also have to consider taking this back a little bit. the Fiesta del Muerte and the art that came out of that. You know, and they're very silly, and they are making fun of death and scary things. And do you think that kind of was brought in or affected, especially in the Halloween time of year with monsters and all this? And people maybe psychologically need to be able to make fun of things that frighten them.
That's an interesting point. Roger White, what do you think? That the whole idea of turning something scary into something that's a source of amusement,
yeah,
defangs it.
I think it's really central for Sendak, even for the Muppets. You know, if they weren't sometimes like actually a little bit creepy, I think they'd be a lot less charming. It would just be cuddly. You know, there's sort of a ogre versus teddy bear dichotomy going on, and you need a little bit of both. You know, and that's sort of what makes these stories, you know, really important and really stay with you and psychologically relevant is that, you know, yeah, it's a bit creepy in any way to deal with monsters.
Let's hear from Jessica in Moneta, Virginia. Jessica, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was just thinking about listening to the program about the monsters, and I just was thinking about when I was a kid and my mom used to rent on Laserdisc Pete's Dragon, and just Pete's Dragon was such a sweet movie because Pete had his imaginary dragon friend, or invisible one, rather. And the dragons always historically have been kind of mean and scary. And to have a dragon portrayed, sorry, my phone's beeping, have a dragon portrayed that way, I thought was always really, really fun. And my kids like watching the movie now.
Jessica, thanks for your call. Yeah, the friendly dragon theme is almost as prevalent as the friendly monster theme.
Yeah, I wonder how far back it goes. I mean, when was the first friendly dragon, do you think?
Puff? I don't know.
Yeah, probably it was Puff, which is probably around the same time as the Wild Things, in fact. You know, I think the 60s were a very good time for friendly monsters.
Let's hear from Ray Allen in Boston. Welcome to the program, Ray Allen.
Hey, so the monsters in Where the Wild Things Are, is they're really the monsters within Max. He's having a temper tantrum, and the monsters take over his world, and then he slowly finds his way back in. And I think that's really the story that Maurice is telling in the story. And I really like the use of white space in the book, where in the beginning he's a little angry, and by the middle of the book there's no white space on the page at all. And little by little the white space creeps back in, and he finds himself in his peaceful room at the end.
Are you going to go see the movie?
No, I think I am, but I'll probably not like it because the movie usually ruins the book.
We have a similar email from Lori in Champaign, Illinois, who says, let's not forget about the psychological allegory Wild Things seems to provide to children, in part the acceptance of anger as temporary and fantasies of wild, uncivilized, or animal-like behavior as acceptable parts of one's psyche.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's really interesting in the book that, you know, obviously Max, the whole thing starts because he puts on this wolf suit, you know, and that's sort of, you know, Sendak says that that's what causes this, you know, ruckus, and he gets sent to bed without a supper. And then, of course, he meets these creatures of his imagination who are, you know, like actual monsters. He's sort of playing at it, but then these are the real thing, these wild things. But, yeah, once again, you know, by the end of it, he's sort of got it under control. You know,
right, and his dinner is still hot.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Let's hear from Alana in Powell, Wyoming. Alana, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to relate a little story. My sons adored the book Where the Wild Things Are, and we read it most every night. And, of course, as children do, while it scared them, they wanted to hear it again and again. We would read it, and then they would express concern that the wild things might come and to their bedroom and take them somewhere. So we made a concoction, a special magic potion of water and glitter in an atomizer spray bottle, and I would give it to them, and it was magical. It could make those monsters go back to their island. And so they had control of things and continued to love the story of Max and the Wild Things.
Wow, that is some magical potion right there, Alana.
It truly is. And my background in early childhood helped me to know the right thing to do.
We also have an email from Margaret Ann in Oro Valley, Arizona, who says, when I was a child, maybe 3 or 4 years old, I once told my mother there was something under my bed. I could hear it breathing. When I insisted, she finally came and looked and found the neighbor's Irish setter had somehow got in and stationed himself under my bed, breathing audibly.
We'll never doubt her again, right?
That's right. So, Roger White, do you have a favorite monster?
I'm probably a Godzilla man also, actually, like Doc. There was something wonderful. I used to perch myself by the TV hoping that they would rerun one of the films. And what I liked the most about it, I think, was that it was obviously a guy in a rubber suit walking through a small-scale model of New York. And it was just, I sort of wanted a Godzilla suit like that, really.
Roger White, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Roger White is a painter and the founding editor of the art journal Paper Monument. We have a link to his article in the Boston Globe. It's called Monsters, Inc., How Maurice Sendak Made the World Safe for Monsters and Vice Versa. You can find it at npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. He joined us today from Middlebury College in Vermont.